Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Hope you and your family had a wonderful Easter Sunday, a beautiful balmy day and cool evening here in the desert. Tonight, I think we've got something that people will be talking about for a long time. The kind of program that tomorrow, you and your friends around the water cooler, you'd be asking each other, what'd you think about that? Did you hear that? What the? If you follow the UFO topic long enough, you know, you start to see cycles, stuff that comes in predictable waves. And long ago, it used to be the saucers themselves. They'd suddenly flood the skies in waves all over the world. In more recent years, it's been waves of stories, sometimes disinformation, anticipation, predictions of imminent disclosure. Yeah, any minute now, we're going to, you know, roll open the hangar doors and let us see the recovered alien spacecraft. Family tours of Area 51. Bring mom, bring the kids, toss grandpa in the station wagon, head out to Groom Lake to see the alien bodies in formaldehyde. And then, you know, months drag on, years go by, nothing happens. Then someone else starts leaking the story that the big announcement is just around the corner. We've been through it a few times, a couple of times when this has happened. When the buzz has been building up to a near crescendo, it was done on purpose to mess with our heads, to confuse the Russians, maybe, to watch and learn how information spreads in the digital age, or for other purposes maybe we can't even imagine. A few times, the buzz was started by presidents or presidential candidates. Jimmy Carter promised to open up the UFO files if he got elected, because he'd seen one. Ronald Reagan, who also had a UFO experience, talked about aliens in five different speeches, including one he made to the United Nations. Bill Clinton made no secret of his interest in the topic. He sent one of his closest friends to Area 51 to find out what was up, and his wife Hillary, first lady at the time, met with Lawrence Rockefeller. Their White House chief of staff, a guy named John Podesta, has been widely quoted for years now talking about his personal interest in UFOs, finding and releasing the UFO files. I don't know if you can hear it, but the buzz is building again. Mrs. Clinton, whether you believe it or not, she's running for president. She's probably going to get the nomination. She made comments to a reporter a couple of months ago and then to Jimmy Kimmel a few nights ago saying she wants to locate and open whatever UFO files exist, whether you believe it or not. It is remarkable that we have a major presidential candidate talking about this. During the campaign, I mentioned last week that I had aired a TV news story based on an interview with John Podesta, in which Podesta was saying basically the same thing as his candidate, Secretary Clinton, about finding and releasing the UFO files. That story was picked up all over the world, repackaged and reported, re-reported. Maybe you heard our colleague Linda Howe telling her audiences that 2016 is going to be a big year about revelations on this topic. Late last year, a panel of former CIA employees openly talked about Area 51. You know, it wasn't that long ago that agency, the military, both pretended there is no base out there at all. It's non-existent. Then they denied it was ever called Area 51. Now they're having open discussions in the public at museums about some of the programs carried out there in secrecy in the desert. It's an amazing turnaround. Earlier this year, when the X-Files TV series returned to television, the CIA and FBI both made a point of telling the public, hey, go online, check out our UFO files. We got it posted there, documents that have been released under the Freedom of Information Act. And there are other signs, other benchmarks that we will discuss tonight. It makes you wonder, what's going on here? And into the middle of this buzz comes Tom DeLonge, a rock star, seemingly an improbable UFO messiah. Could Tom DeLonge do what generations of UFO researchers, scientists, government insiders, and whistleblowers have been unable to do? Tell the story, dig out the real story, and tell it in a way that has not been told before. How to make sense out of the alleged cover-up, why it started, how it's been maintained, but also to understand who the visitors are, or more precisely, who the others are. And I'm using air quotes around the others. That's the term used by some of the high-level sources developed by musician Tom DeLonge. The story of how he got to where he is and what he's learned so far should be a movie, and maybe it will be a movie. But over the next 4 hours, we're going to hear this tale, how he started down this unlikely road, the dramatic business decision he made about a year ago, changing the direction of his life and his fortune, and the amazing series or chain of events which have led Tom from one insider to another, stitching together an informal network of like-minded people who now seem to want the public to know the story. If you think you know how it works or why it's been handled this way, hold on to your seats, because the tale you're going to hear tonight will turn things upside down. I guess the question is, can we believe it? Is it disinformation? Is it a trick or misdirection? Is Tom DeLonge being used or played, or is he really onto something of global significance? It's going to be fun finding out. Tom will join me a few minutes from now, and we will start peeling back the layers of the onion to reveal what's underneath. And also tonight in Hour 2, a New York Times bestselling author, A.J. Hartley. He's the co-author with Tom DeLonge on the first book in a series, Secret Machines, Chasing Shadows. He'll join us for a couple of segments to share stories about the steep learning curve involved in this journey of discovery these guys have been making. I want to mention a couple of news items quickly. Cross your fingers, hope the best for a guy who's been my guest on this program a couple of times, Robert Bigelow, space entrepreneur, from Las Vegas. He founded his company, Bigelow Aerospace, back in 1999, built it from scratch with his own money. On an April 8th, he is scheduled to have one of his spacecraft launched aboard a SpaceX rocket, and if all goes well, it will dock with the ISS, the International Space Station. It will become an adjunct to the ISS, give them more space up there, and if things work out as planned, it could lead to very big things for the Bigelow Company and for commercial development of space. NASA, just this past week, talking openly about a manned lunar base within a matter of a couple of years. And this mission could play a big part in that, because the same spacecraft that's going to be launched this week could be a model for the habitat used on the lunar surface. Did you hear the story about the Roswell saucer being stolen? It's a model flying saucer that's been an attraction outside the UFO Museum in Roswell since that place opened years ago. Three nitwits were seen on video stealing it, took it off, hauled it off in a truck. The craft was later found in the desert, smashed to pieces. I think unintentionally ironic, since that's what eyewitnesses say the real Roswell craft was like when it was found back in 1947, smashed into pieces on the desert floor. No arrests made yet, but I hope they catch these knuckleheads. The museum, I don't think it has such a huge profit margin, probably can't afford this loss. Webmaster Lex Lonehood and I have put together our usual assortment of news items and oddities. We posted on the Coast to Coast website under Naps News, included tonight some timely topics, a story about UFO politics in the current presidential campaign, speculation about how various candidates might treat this issue, whether they'd release information to the public if they could locate any files. A somewhat disturbing story about the FBI's interest in the political preferences of private citizens. This came spilling out in a court battle underway in California. An interesting piece about the brains of people who believe in the supernatural, and a depressing story about how artificial intelligence learned a great deal about humanity by interacting on the Twitterverse. That and more on the Naps News segment. While you're on the Coast website, check out how to become a Coast Insider, also how to subscribe to George Norrie's television program. The links are right there when you visit the site, both great ideas. And with that, let's get down to business. You know the drill, folks. Bring in the dog and cat, fire up the coffee pot, pour yourself a mug of something, throw a log on the fire, slip into those jammies and bunny slippers, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. Tom DeLonge, the great UFO adventure story, and maybe a surprise ending. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I got a call about 5 years ago, I think it was, out of the blue, from a guy who said his name was Tom DeLonge. And he had a band called Blink 182. And I'd heard of them, of course, and I'd heard his name. That band has sold, I don't know, close to 30 million albums. It remains wildly popular even now. Tom was the co-founder, lead guitarist, and vocalist. And about 10 years ago, sort of as a side project, he co-founded another band called Angels and Airwaves. It's also been very successful. But his passion all this time, through much of his life, has been UFOs. And the topic of aliens and UFOs would pop up in his song lyrics now and then. I think some of his fans probably would groan about it. It drove him crazy from time to time. After Tom had called me that first time to talk about UFOs, we continued our communications over the years. He joined me on this program a couple of times and then allowed me sort of a front row seat to what he's been doing. About a year ago, his life took a very dramatic turn. He announced he's leaving Blink 182, which caused a furor with his hardcore fans, of course, said he was going to refocus his professional life. The working umbrella title, Secret Machines, an ambitious multi-platform effort, films, documentaries, books, fiction and nonfiction. We're going to talk about all those, and we're going to talk about the unexpected turn that things took for Tom, something truly unusual that happened along the way, the contacts he made in the UFO field that are absolutely unprecedented. Welcome back to the program, Tom DeLonge. Tom, good
to
have
you. How are
you? I hope I didn't build it up too much there.
You know, I was listening to that intro, and I was like, my God, I sound amazing. And I'm sitting here kind of going, oh, they're all going to figure me out pretty soon that I'm just a pretty normal guy. But I'm so excited to be here. This is always – I listened to Coast to Coast for 20-some years, and this is my third time being on here, and
yeah.
It's such a rush.
Well, this one's going to be a rush for everybody, I think, involved. I want to start with a little bit about you. I know you don't want to talk about this, but just for the benefit of the listeners who were not Blink or Angels fans, tell me a little bit about the musical career, how well you did, because the decision you made to change away from that, at least to some extent, it becomes all the more dramatic.
Yeah, well, I've been playing music as far back as I can remember, and when you start a band, you never think that you're going to go anywhere. So the biggest dreams and aspirations I had at the time were to play in front of neighbors, you know. So I was like having these big, you know, fanciful daydreams about playing in my cul-de-sac growing up, but the band was at the right place at the right time, and we did something that I think resonated with a lot of kids at the time. We kind of became the band known for, you know, speaking for suburbia, and then MTV was exploding. So with a little bit of luck, we had kind of some of the right material to land on that channel. And then, you know, the band exploded in the 90s, and we, ever since, we've had a career. And along the way, you know, you mentioned, yeah, I had other things I was into. There was always so much more to who I was, but, you know, obviously everyone knows me because of the music, but, you know, just like anybody else out there, when I'm not on stage for the other 23 hours of the day, I was always doing other stuff.
I kid you about this, both in person and once on the air before, about your fans. You know, since I've come to know you, I follow you on social media, and I see what the fans say. Oh, no, there's Tom on his UFO binge again. So they chide you a little bit. Some of it is, you know, is fun, and some of it they don't want you to deal with it. But it's always been there.
Well, you know, I will tell you this, and I think I even mentioned this to you in some of our conversations that weren't on the air. Is I've even dealing with the Secret Machines project, I have met or come across people that, you know, the subject can rub people the wrong way. But I found people that have built up walls that have been, you know, so much taller and thicker than any wall that you would think somebody would build up, maybe because they're scared of the belief systems that they have and they don't want, you know, you're coming at them with something that really shakes them. So, you know, but I don't know if that's the way, you know, fans and people are in the, you know, on my social media, if they're scared of the material or they just want me to go focus and do the music that they grew up and love, which is probably most likely it. But just for conversation's sake, you know, being into this subject, and you know this even more than I, some people just like, nope, don't want to hear it, blinders on, I got to go to work, you know, and
right.
And sometimes they see it on the internet too.
Let's talk about your own experience, because you had an interest in this for a long time before you had anything like a paranormal or UFO type experience. But on a camping trip, this is fairly recently, you had something really strange happen out in the desert.
Yeah, I did. You know, and it's been the subject of a lot of interviews lately. We just had Rolling Stone embed a journalist with me last week for a handful of days, and they're going to help break this story right after we do tonight in the next issue of Rolling Stone, which is on the 8th. But even he was bringing up, he's like, what's going on with this camping trip, you know? I did an interview with Paper Magazine, kind of, they're like a modern art magazine, and they wanted to do something on this subject, and they asked me, and I just kind of let the floodgates open. Once again, you know, I'm just talking and thinking out loud as I'm talking, and then you see it in print later, and you go, oh my God, people aren't going to understand this, and they're going to think I'm nuts. But, you know, what's really interesting, before I tell you what's interesting here, let me tell you about what happened. We went out on to go film, and it was part of this documentary for the Secret Machines Project, and we wanted to go out and start collecting footage. So we were on our way out to the what's known as the NTS or Nevada Test Site. You are the person who kind of told the entire world about the existence of Area 51. I mean, for anyone listening, if you know the term Area 51, George here is the one that taught you it. But that's not the only base out there. There's a lot of bases out there. There's a few bases, you know, out west of there, and one was called China Lake. And we were trying to get our way out there, but it was too far of a drive at the time, so we decided to pull off the road outside of China Lake, and we were probably 100 miles from any gas station. I mean, we were somewhere on the fringes of Death Valley, but all I know is that we were off-roading for quite a while until we found a valley to camp in. And so I've done it a few other times for fun, and we have to go backwards a little bit. There was an individual that was very prominent in the UFO field for a while, and he was kind of all the rage, and he came up with this whole concept that the UFOs themselves or any advanced civilization was going to speak to communicate on the level of consciousness, the frequency of consciousness. They're not going to be using, you know, AM, FM radios or whatever. So he had this whole concept that if you meditate and you do a certain protocol when you meditate, these things can show up, you know. And I didn't know what to believe at the time, but I did meet a few professors from universities that were working with this guy, and they told me directly, oh my God, we've seen landings and stuff. And I was like, really? Really? You know, so we would go out there. I took a couple buddies out there, and we would have fun and not really be sober, but we wanted to try it out either. Nothing ever really happened for us. But on this camping trip, we said, let's do it again, you know, and so you're not doing anything. You're in the middle of the desert. So we tried it. And I remember when right before we start this meditative kind of the protocol, you know, it's step by step. You got to do certain things. I remember telling them, okay, I don't think anything's going to happen necessarily. We should try this. But if anything does happen, it's going to happen at 3 in the morning, you know. And the two guys that were with me were like, why 3? I'm like, I don't know. It's just what time it always happens. If you read about people that have, like, abductions or if they have sightings or anything that's weird at night with this phenomenon, somehow it always happens around that time, or a lot of the time it does. So we go through, like, a couple hours of this meditation. Nothing happens. And then finally we're like, okay, it's time to go to bed, you know. So we all cram into this tent in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we are in the middle of nowhere, and the fire's still going on outside the tent. So it's kind of all illuminated in there. So you get the sleeping bags, right, you know, say a few dumb jokes, and we go to sleep. I wake up, and I hear hundreds of people talking around the tent, like hundreds, like so many voices. I can't make out anything. It was a chorus of voices. Then all of a sudden this thought enters my mind instantly. Oh, it's just a bunch of special ops soldiers on some multi-day hike coming through our tent area. Everything's cool. We're good, you know. And I close my eyes, open back up. The fire's out. A couple hours have passed, and I'm like, what the hell was that? So I woke everybody up first thing in the morning, super early. And I was like, oh my God, did you guys hear that? Did you hear that? Did you hear all those voices? And one guy was like, no, not at all. I slept fine. But the other guy was like, yes, I heard people talking all around our tent. So I wasn't the only one. So I didn't feel too wildly crazy. But this is where it gets really interesting. You know, George, you know, John, is it John Keel, the researcher from the 70s?
Yeah.
Our good friend Jeremy Corbell actually Instagrammed his book Trojan Horse not too long ago. It's from the 70s. It had a reprint. And because Jeremy Instagrammed it, I was like, oh, I want to check that book out. So I bought it. And I'm reading it, and I was like, oh, my God. Somewhere around the first third of the book, it gets into this whole this is from the 70s, mind you. It gets into this whole scenario where a lady sees a UFO. Her car gets pushed over to the side of the road, and then she hears a chorus or a choir of voices, just so many voices she can't hear what it is. They're swirling around the entire area, and just step by step goes through the exact same thing that happened to me out in the desert. So as we get into the conversation later tonight, one of the first things I did when I met the very important people we're going to talk about, I sent that over and I said, this is exactly what went on with.
Sorry to interrupt you. Marvin Gaye is telling us we need to take a break. Our conversation with Tom DeLonge will pick up in a minute, and we'll get back into that story of his strange experience in the desert. Much more to come here at Coast to Coast AM. I don't know if my guest tonight would agree with this, but I think this is a musical ancestor of Tom DeLonge's, surf rockers known as the Shantays, a song called Pipeline from way back in 1963. We're talking with my guest Tom DeLonge about a somewhat amazing transformation he's made in his personal and professional life, sort of rechanneling his fortune and his energies away from music and into UFOs. And whether you believe the story that we're going to tell tonight about these amazing contacts that he's made who want this story out, there's nobody that's launched anything quite like this project, Secret Machines, movies, films, books, documentaries, and we're going to get into that in the next segment. Stick around, much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So for the last 60 years or so, if you say UFO, somebody saw a UFO, the thoughts go to space aliens. These might be visitors from some other planet. People like John Keel, who was just mentioned a bit ago by Tom DeLonge, and Jacques Vallée and others put a twist on that starting in the 70s, saying maybe these UFOs, the things we're seeing in the skies, are not interplanetary spacecraft after all. Maybe they're something from closer to home. Tom, tell me this. Did this experience you had in the desert, which was not sort of a classical alien-type encounter, did it sort of change your take on the overall topic?
You know, I don't know if it added to my take. I've never believed that UFOs were as simple as just, you know, a life, you know, some kind of life form from another planet. I always thought it was much more complex than that. You know, this to me, I thought that Jacques Vallée and John Keel, they were both offering explanations that were really making somebody think about the absurdity of what UFOs do when people have some type of contact or the abduction experiences or all the cattle mutilations and crop circles and just the weird stuff that it's doing, and that even religious stuff, and the messages it's telling people. So when I had my experience, it just kind of added more fuel to the fire that it's a little bit more complex than that. And but honestly, that's one of the great things about the phenomenon. Once you start studying it, and once you try and find, different rabbit holes to jump into, it's kind of never ending because there's so much about this topic and about the phenomenon itself that you can learn for the next, 500 decades and only kind of, break through the surface of it.
So tell me this, how big a role did that experience play in the ultimate decision you made about a year ago to sort of change the focus?
Well, for people that are wondering if I care about music, I do. I'm doing more music now than I ever have, but it is a major shift. So I have a company called To the Stars, and what we're doing is kind of communicating large themes and ideas in what's called is transmedia, where you do multi-platform releases on a subject. So that's no different than what you see on your big Marvel or DC Comics movies or stuff that Disney does, even Star Wars, where it's a franchise. It's an idea that lasts for many years, and they do a lot of movies. They'll do animations. They'll do books or whatever. Secret Machines is like that. All of the releases I'm doing have a piece of music with it, but I was, I'm more interested in things that are very challenging and things that are ambitious. I don't do well doing the same thing over and over again. If I'm not engaged cerebrally, I kind of feel like I'm dying a slow little death here. So I definitely put a lot on my plate this time.
So describe it. Describe the parameters of this project, what it involves.
Well, I knew that this was the greatest story never told. I knew that you don't even have to sensationalize anything about this subject and would blow people's minds. I also knew that it's never really been told in an elevated artistic way. You never really had, other than Close Encounters that Spielberg did so many years ago, that's probably the only one on a major level that took it decently seriously and put concepts out there for people to digest and think about and walk away saying, wow, you know, because it was so elevated in the approach. I mean, it's the best director of all time. I thought that we kind of needed to do something like that again. But because I do know a lot about this subject and I do know the complexities involved and I do know that it is a national security issue and a global security issue, that I didn't want to come out and be this very public figure saying some of these things that I knew needed to be said without permission. So the whole project was, how do we do major motion pictures with documentaries, with novels, with nonfiction books, with step by step we kind of entertain and educate? And it all went back to not too many years ago when I was watching that movie 13 Days with Kevin Costner on the Cuban Missile Crisis. We've all been told about the Cuban Missile Crisis in school. They're like, oh my God, we almost died, and they're going to put weapons in Cuba, and we almost died. Did we tell you that we almost died? You know, and you're like, okay, I got it. And you walk out of high school, and you don't really, the enormity of it thrown on your lap, you don't really digest it. So I was watching that movie, and it kind of, you know, step by step, you go through the debates, and you're seeing the arguments, you're seeing the fear, and you're seeing how families act, and you're like, wow, that was a pretty heavy time in our history. So I left and I went to the bookstore to buy the actual recordings of JFK in the Oval Office. I wanted to hear those debates. I wanted to hear, you know, how they dealt with the, you know, the idea that nuclear war could break out at any minute. I wanted to see what those guys were saying, you know, to figure it out, to decode that problem. And that's what I want to do with this project, where you pull people in and you galvanize them over the issue, and then they want to go and absorb the nonfiction elements. But a funny story to that JFK thing, when I was standing in line with the JFK tapes, all these CDs at the time, actually, of all the recordings of JFK, my phone rings, and I go, hello, and they go, Tom DeLong. I go, yeah. And he goes, this is Senator Ted Kennedy. And I was like, wait, what? He goes, this is Senator Ted Kennedy. And I paused for a second. I was like, I'm holding recordings of your brother. He's all, you are? And I was like, yeah. He's all, hold on a second. He grabs somebody else, gets on the phone. He's all, Tom, this is Senator John Kerry. Come campaign with me. and I got into campaigning in Iowa, and people saw me in the elections during that time when he was running for president. But this whole entertain and educate model, I think, is something that needs to happen.
So to begin with, the books, you have six in mind to start with. Fiction, nonfiction?
Yeah, so we actually have four of them done. The fictional, what we call historical fiction, or another way that one of my advisors put out for us to put on there was threading historical events. But that is coming out on April 5th everywhere. And then we'll follow it with the first nonfiction book, and we'll just go back and forth between the fiction and the nonfiction. We're almost done with the three nonfiction books. We have one completely done, and the other two will be done in the next couple weeks. So, but the novel itself, it's all 700 pages of it, will be in stores everywhere on the 5th.
Well, we're going to talk about Secret Machines Chasing Shadows in the next hour when we're joined by your co-author. But can you talk about the nonfiction books, what the general subjects are?
Yeah, so for some of the people out there that live in this world like myself, I teamed up with an internationally recognized researcher named Peter Lavenda. Peter is what you would call an expert at the occult, and he did a lot of famous research about the Nazis and the rat lines and what the Germans were doing after World War II and all the occult, all the weird occult stuff that they were into. And when people start to understand more about the UFO phenomenon, and when they they follow what Seeker Machines is going to teach them. And mind you, as we'll talk about this in a little bit, it's not all coming from me. It's coming from other people of the highest places. That, you know, the term the occult in that whole world is much more a part of the UFO phenomenon than that's part of what makes it more complex than just little green men and flying saucers and tinfoil hats, you know. So Peter has been writing the nonfiction books for just as long as AJ's been writing the fictional books. So we've been working on this for a while.
The documentary projects, nonfiction documentaries that you've been working on, I've seen glimpses, some of the stuff, some of the interviews you've done. I guess part of that story is the contacts that were developed in the course of putting that together. But tell me about the documentary projects as much as you want to reveal right now about the kind of people you're talking to and what those subjects will be.
Sure. Well, when we started this project, I wanted to document my efforts of meeting the people in charge and telling the story about how I am basically building, hopefully, you know, one of the largest covert communications vehicles that's been put together. And because I can't come out and tell everybody who these people are, and because I can't run around showing pictures and resumes and bios of who these, where these people have been, I figured the next best way to do it is to document and to tell the story of how I met these people and the information they've been giving me, and how we're going to attempt to communicate some of these things to people. And it's big stuff. And some of it's scary stuff. And like I said earlier, it's going to hit people's belief systems pretty hard on some issues. And you know, it just needs to come out over time. And we need to finesse a certain way to build it all on first. You know, finesse it in a way to where we build it all on credibility. So when they read the Seeker Machines novel and novels, they understand that we're not just trying to entertain them, that there's things in this book that were given to me that have never been given to the world ever in relationship to what the UFO phenomenon is and where it's from and what it's doing. A lot of this book is laying the foundation for even bigger stuff that's coming on book two.
I want to talk for a moment about the political scene. And I'm not endorsing Hillary Clinton. I'm not endorsing John Podesta. I don't think you are either. I just find it amazing, and I don't even know if they could release the UFO files, even if they could find them. I just find it amazing that during the heat of a campaign that they're talking about it, somewhere it would seem like they've done a big focus group or something that says it's okay. But to me, it doesn't make any sense. It just seems like it's a downer, that it could be something they'd be beaten over the head with. Yet you've had very open communications with Podesta. His interest in this goes way, way back, as does hers.
Yeah, I think people need to take, very, very, very strong notice of what's going on when Hillary Clinton comes on the Jimmy Kimmel show like she did a couple nights ago and says, we are going to dig in and bring out the UFO files, quote, unless it has to do with national security. That was the one caveat. So she's saying this needs to come out, but there might be some things that's going to hold some of it back. And she's letting you know with breadcrumbs here that there are national security issues with this stuff, and there are global security issues with this stuff. So her campaign manager, John Podesta, is a very, very powerful and important person. And a lot of this audience knows of him because he tweeted a few times about UFOs. One of his famous tweets last year was that his biggest failure for 2014 was not getting the UFO files released. But you have to look at who he is. He got President Clinton elected and was his chief of staff and got Obama elected and served as his transitional chief of staff and served for the majority of Obama's tenure as his senior advisor. And now he's the campaign chairman for Hillary. So if Hillary wins, he'll most likely be chief of staff for her. So you have a guy that's routinely getting people elected to the highest office in the world and then staying on to either run their office or be their senior advisor. And he's out there talking about UFOs like it's anything else. And he is in my docuseries. And he was, the story there was I reached out and I told him what I was trying to achieve with this project. And he was very quiet on the phone. He was listening. And I kind of went through what my objectives were. And I have my pitch down, but I'm speaking very respectfully, and I'm trying to lay out, you know, all the reasons why this needs to happen. But I didn't think that I really got through to him. And for all I knew, he thought I was just some crazy, you know, rock star that wants to talk about something weird, you know, but I knew he was into this stuff, but I just didn't know how much or whatever. So he said, call me in a couple months. I'm pretty busy and we'll see where we're at. I was like, cool. I never called him back because I didn't think he was really, you know, absorbing what I pitched him. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I just get this flurry of emails from his office that he wants to be in this. And I have to come out to D.C., and it's a major priority, and the rest is history. But I think people need to understand that we're in a transition here with this topic, and that some really big things are about to happen.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at here, is because I know for some listeners who just can't stand Hillary Clinton, it's trouble. They have trouble even listening to this part of it. But just set that stuff aside for a second and think for a moment about the significance of a major presidential candidate talking about this issue. It's like somebody flipped a light switch or something.
Well, you have an issue that's going to tackle cosmology and religion and scientific breakthroughs that will seem like magic to people. Relationships with countries that we're not supposed to have relationships with. Defense systems that we've been building secretly with enormous amounts of money for a very long period of time, where people, if they knew about it, would probably be in an uproar until they knew the reasons why. And then they would say, why didn't you tell me? I wish I could have helped you. You know, the more that I found out about this stuff, and once they started giving me the information, I realized that all these young people are going to look at these areas of our government and say, you guys are heroes. You guys are doing heroic stuff, incredible stuff, and no one knows about it. And you're letting all these weirdos on the internet define you and say it's all a big conspiracy. It's the big, bad secret government, you know, keeping secrets because they're better than us, or we can't handle the truth, or they're doing it for money and to be the control of the world. Nothing could be further from the truth. Once you understand why they're keeping their efforts secret and what they've been doing, you will realize that they need to be empowered, and they need to be given every bit of resource that they could possibly need for what they're doing. And I'm excited to tell that part of the story. I'm excited for people to understand that these are good people doing important work, that thank God they were doing it.
Well, what it makes you wonder is, I made the comparison to somebody flipping a light switch, whether a green light has been given to a variety of people in the government that it's okay to start dribbling stuff out. I mean, people are talking to you. Someone somewhere knows those conversations are underway. I'm just wondering where ultimately this come from. Did they have a conference call and everybody said, okay, now's the time? Or what do you think about it?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I think that I came in and brought an idea to the table that they don't readily have. I said, you know, I walked in there with a voice, that they don't really have a position that speaks to young people the way I do. I also walked in there with, a thesis on the phenomenon that is correct, that's totally different than just visitors from another planet. So when they saw that I actually knew what I was talking about, I think that caught them a little bit off guard. And then I also said, I have a plan to do something that looks like this, and I kind of laid out the whole Secret Machines project, and they probably thought that was really interesting. But when I started executing, when I actually started doing the work and pulling the people together and getting all these advisors and writing the novel, and the novel being good and the documentary being good, and everything happening the way I said it would, I think I built up an enormous amount of trust with these guys. But we have to be really clear here. I'm very respectful. I'm very formal about it. Everything's a yes sir and no sir. I'm speaking to guys where you can count all the stars on their shoulders. I mean, really. And I try to run this like a real program, the way they would want it run. So everything gets approval. Everything gets sent over, and I get, you know, just to give you guys an idea, I got a call that I was going to do a big interview with Newsweek last week. And so I did the interview. And at the end of the interview, I found out that it was a fake interview and that my company set it up as a way for someone to help me craft the message for this because they knew that I was dealing with national security, and that's not something that a musician normally ever has to, you know, worry about. So they set up this fake interview. So it wasn't a news, you know, it was somebody to help me. They say, well, look, this is the kinds of things you're saying, you know, and maybe you shouldn't say this way. But the cool thing about it was they recorded it. So I took that recording, and instantly I was happy about that. Everything else, I was like, cool, tell me something, you know, help me say things in a better way. But I went that evening, took that recording, and I sent it off to the main man out of 10 advisors I have. And he's a very big deal. I got feedback, and I got 4 pages of notes of feedback. You know, things like saying, stop calling it the phenomenon, call it UFOs, make sure people understand what you're talking about.
All right. In the next hour, we're going to invite your co-author of Secret Machines, the first book, A.J. Hartley, onto the program to talk about the learning curve for him. Then we're going to get into this, these 10 advisors or so that you put together one by one, how you got together with them and the kinds of things that they have told you so far. Much more to come here with my guest, Tom DeLonge, on Coast to Coast AM.